Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm delighted to have you here with me today. Today we're going to talk about some of the advances in drug development and the challenges of drug development. It's not an easy undertaking at all, and it's a lot of new words for us that would be appearing in the press. So today we're going to talk about a new targeted cancer therapy. Before we get into today's topic, though, I wanted to remind you that today's program is brought to you every week by the VHL Family Alliance. It stands for Von Hippel-Lindau Disease. The program is designed to be of interest to people with any complex medical condition, which we define as you're dealing with more than one medical specialist. So if you have more than one medical specialist in your life, then you too have a complex medical condition. And that forces us to be a coordinator ourselves of a lot of our medical care, because it doesn't always happen automatically. So people with complex medical conditions or disabilities will find things of interest here, and we hope that you will enjoy today's show. Let me play a little bit of information for you, please, about VHL, and then we'll be right back to introduce today's guest.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back, and don't forget to check out VHL.org. We've been talking a lot about Grey's Anatomy and the patient on Grey's Anatomy who has VHL, so it's all a very interesting discussion. So today's guest is Mr. Robert Brooks from the Genesis Biopharma Organization. Welcome, Mr. Brooks.
Hi, Joyce. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. So what is Genesis Biopharma?
Sure. So we're, again, I'll say thanks for having me. I hope what I talk about today is of some value to the listeners. So Genesis Biopharma is an early-stage biotechnology company that's developing a targeted cancer therapy for what we deem to be highly aggressive or drug-resistant types of cancer. And it's a fairly unique program because we were converting what was originally used as a diagnostic imaging agent for cancer into a therapeutic antibody program.
That's very interesting. So as a diagnostic agent, they usually cook up a tracer, or you tell me what the better word is, that will seek out a particular cell type and cling to it. So then when they do the images, it sort of lights up like a light bulb. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, tracer is a good word for it. Sometimes it's a radioactive tracer. And with this particular program, it was used as a diagnostic imaging agent dating back to the late 80s and 90s, and used at the University of Nottingham in England. And
yep.
It was funded by Cancer Research UK, which is kind of akin to the National Cancer Institute here in the U.S. And it was where they had injected cancer into mice, and they were trying to isolate these antibodies that were part of the natural immune response to cancer. And what they found was that one particular antibody out of the ones that were isolated had kind of amazing selectivity for a wide variety of tumor types. And
so would you define antibody for us?
Sure. So an antibody is kind of part of your immune system. It's produced by your immune system in response typically to like bacterial or viral infections, or it's part of the immune system that identifies foreign material inside your body. And so when an antibody identifies and attaches a tumor cell or bacteria or a virally infected cell, then it kind of tags that cell for a later response by the immune system and in effect the killing of that cell, ideally.
So it's sort of our body's spies, and it goes and it tags these, as you say, marks them so that we can target them in some other way later.
Right. Yeah, the immune system is pretty complex, so antibodies are really only one component of it.
Right.
But, yeah, they do certainly play a role. They play a role in bacterial infections, viral infections, and also cancer. And there's a lot that's being studied by academics and universities currently that is trying to tease out exactly how the immune system is involved in cancer and what exactly the role of these antibodies are in responding to cancer, and they kind of define it as a process that occurs in three stages, the three E's they call, where there's an initial phase of elimination where antibodies are able to tag cancer cells and the immune system just wipes out certain cancer cells. And then there's a second phase of equilibrium where the cancer or the tumor kind of grows a bit, and then the immune system fights back against it, but they're kind of matching each other blow for blow, and the tumor is kind of staying stable. But then there's a third phase they call escape, where this is where the unchecked growth of the cancer cell begins, and eventually the cancer tumor starts growing and growing.
Sort of escapes the effect of the weapon.
Right, of the natural immune response. Yeah.
Okay. So when we tag things for elimination, it's sort of like the way they go through and put red X's on trees and say, cut this one down.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the immune system has a very exquisite system for kind of recognizing what's part of the what should be there and what shouldn't be there, right? So when it finds something that that seems foreign material, then it tags it, and it starts mounting an immune response where other immune cells are recruited to the site and affect cell killing. So.
Now, what's a monoclonal antibody? I see that word in the press, and I saw it in your press release, too.
Sure. So a monoclonal antibody is a type of antibody that is selective for a single target or a single protein within the body. And the discovery of antibodies and of this technology is fairly recent, where they started isolating them from mice in around 1975. They started engineering their use for human clinical indications in around 1990. But kind of the concept is an old one, where it dates back to around the late 19th century. They say 1897 is when a researcher, Paul Ehrlich, had discovered that, or had theorized that based on different receptors found on different cells within the body, you could effectively find magic bullets that could selectively identify the foreign material or selectively identify the bad cells and eliminate them. And so that concept was put forth, and after kind of years of toil in the lab, they identified these antibodies as particularly good options, because you can kind of harness the natural immune system's capability to generate these antibodies and then find antibodies that are specific for really any protein that you have interest in. But, more on monoclonal antibodies, there are quite a few marketed monoclonal antibody therapies, and that's why I'm sure you hear them in the news. So there's companies like Genentech. They currently have about 60% of the market share for these monoclonal antibody therapies. And the drugs that they have developed are maybe household names, Avastin and Rituximab and Herceptin, Rapiva, Lucentis. So there are a lot of antibody therapies that are in use today. The first one was approved back in 1997, and new monoclonal antibody therapies are being approved each year.
Right, and you mentioned that this yours is CD55.
That's right.
And it was originally used as an imaging tracer to find what to hunt down what particular cell type.
Right. So the original study wasn't looking for a particular. Well, they were looking for cancer. So they were trying to isolate antibodies that would be effectively used as diagnostic imaging agents for cancer, various types of cancer.
Right.
And the way they would have to validate that, as you can imagine, because they didn't know if it was a good diagnostic yet or not, is that they would have to perform biopsies, or that there would be actual observation by the oncologist or surgeon to say that, yeah, we saw this image, but then you have to validate it by saying, yeah, this, and then later during surgery we identified that this agent was binding to a metastatic cancer of the liver in these colorectal cancer patients. But yeah, they did find that this antibody was selective for a wide variety of cancer types. But at the time, they didn't know that CD55 was involved at all. This is back in, again, the late 80s or early 90s. But separately from those efforts, there were a lot of researchers that were trying to understand fundamental tumor biology, kind of what makes a tumor cell tick. And they had found that there's this class of molecules that include CD55 that seem to act as natural cancer defense mechanisms, where in a normal cell, a molecule like CD55 is expressed at a very low level, but it prevents kind of immune system attack of that normal cell. But in a cancer cell, they found that this mechanism kind of gets hijacked, and CD55 gets overexpressed at a high level, and therefore it prevents the cancer cell from being targeted and attacked by the natural immune response. And so again, at the time, they didn't know that this diagnostic imaging agent was related to CD55 at all. It wasn't really until our collaborator, Professor Lindy Durrant at the University of Nottingham, and other researchers there kind of connected the dots, and they found that indeed this antibody that had shown selectivity for a wide variety of cancers was targeting this well-known cancer defense mechanism, CD55. And the whole process was kind of doubly exciting because they found that the antibody was able to neutralize the tumor protective effect of CD55.
Interesting. So let me back up for a sec to make sure everybody's on the same page. So when you say it's a cancer defense mechanism, it's cancer defending itself. It's not us defending ourselves against cancer, but it's the cancer side of the war here defending itself, right?
That's exactly right. So when CD55 is overexpressed to a high degree, it prevents the immune system from mounting a response against it, and it acts as a defense mechanism. And,
right. So let me just walk this through. So what happens to kick off a cancer is that there's some genetic damage by sunshine, radiation, something or other, causes genes to change. Something goes wrong in the cell, and a cancer begins to grow. And our bodies actually have some built-in defense mechanisms that know how to squash those guys when they're really little. So most of those get taken care of by our normal immune system defenses, right? But part of that defense is our body's ability to tell what's normal, what belongs here, what is self, as they say, as opposed to what is not self, what is foreign, what is something that I need to get rid of. Like when we have a splinter, then our bodies mount these defenses and it starts to get this pus around it, which makes it easier to get rid of the splinter. So our bodies have ways of evicting foreign stuff. But in this case, this CD55 is generated as one of the ways that the cancer sort of hides out and says, no, don't bother with me. I'm part of you anyway. I'm self, as opposed to not self. Did I get that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, when it's a normal mechanism that's expressed at low levels on cells to prevent attack by the immune system on what's recognized as self. But then, yeah, like you say, the cancer cell overexpresses it to a high degree, kind of hijacks that program, and then it becomes recognized itself, and it prevents the cancer cell from not only being attacked by the natural immune response, but it also protects it from being impacted by other cancer immunotherapies. And that's one aspect that's exciting about our program, is because other cancer immunotherapies, the other monoclonal antibodies that are marketed by companies like Genentech and others, they act through depositing antibodies on cancer cells, and then that in turn elicits the natural immune response. But when CD55 is overexpressed, it potentially inhibits the activity not only of the natural immune response, but also of these other marketed antibody therapies. And so we're hopeful that if we're able to administer a drug that neutralizes the effects of CD55, we'll be able to resensitize that tumor cell, not only to killing by the natural immune response, but also to killing that's mediated by already marketed antibody therapies, and hopefully make these drugs like rituximab or Avastin or Herceptin more powerful and more effective in a wider patient population. Because you may know many of these therapies, well, there's been recent controversy where Avastin may lose approval for breast cancer in the U.S. I believe it's already been dropped for reimbursement in the U.K. It's for legitimate reasons. The pharma company or biotech company may not agree, but I don't think anyone would dispute that the drug doesn't put people into full remission, and that has to be the end goal. The end goal is to eradicate these cancers and turn them into a chronic condition.
Right, and many of the new drugs, and Avastin is one of them, I'm more familiar with the drugs that are working on kidney cancer, But what we found with so many of them is that they work fairly well in the beginning, but after 9 or 12 months, they kind of run out of gas. As you say, there's this escape phase, or as they call it, resistance sometimes, where the tumor learns how to resist the effects of the drug and start to grow again, even though you're still taking the drug. So is that the kind of response that you're hoping to burst with your anti-CD55?
Yeah, that's right. So with drugs like take rituximab, for instance, this is a drug that's widely used in cancers of the blood, and mm-hmm. it's been shown in certain cell lines that patients, after they've used rituximab let me say that around 50% of patients that use rituximab become refractory, or their cancer becomes resistant to rituximab over the course of 3 or 4 years. And what exactly is the mechanism for that resistance? People don't know exactly, but that's an area of intense study. And some of the initial results with rituximab and with rituximab resistant cell lines has shown that when that cell line becomes resistant to rituximab, CD55 is overexpressed. And that means that it potentially is mediating some of that resistance. And so in these patients that are refractory to rituximab, you could potentially add our therapy and, again, resensitize that tumor cell to the natural immune response, or resensitize that tumor cell to rituximab. And that's the whole concept this is an area of intense study by academics and also pharma and biotech companies is to develop targeted cancer therapies against various mechanisms, but one of them certainly is targeting these cancers that become resistant to the known drugs and that become deemed highly aggressive or drug-resistant cancers.
Exactly, and obviously these new drugs are pretty expensive, so if you're paying, $50,000 a year to be on a drug, and it seemed to have a good response, and then all of a sudden the tumor learns how to grow in spite of it, this is not good news. And so if we can somehow eliminate that rebound, keep the tumor from escaping the effect of the drug, that would be a very good thing.
Right. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly that if companies are going to justify the high price that's paid for these medications, they need to work and they need to be extremely effective. And the system can only last so long reimbursing companies at such high rates for drugs that don't cure cancer, that are only mildly effective. And so that's what everyone is racing to do. There's about 40 commercial stage biotechnology or pharmaceutical companies in the United States that have in excess of $50 billion in cash on hand, which they're actively spending on R&D and on new drug development, trying to find these therapies that are effective. A large majority of their pipelines are filled with monoclonal antibodies and with targeted cancer therapies, with the idea that, they want to find something that is extremely effective in large patient populations and, at the end of the day, helps you do away with the toxic chemotherapy regimen and gives you a therapy that's safe and it's well tolerated, and it's also highly effective in putting cancer into remission.
One of the doctors described to me that the classic chemotherapy, the one we've been used to up to the last 5 or 10 years, is sort of like taking a sledgehammer to it. You hit it with all these toxins, which are in fact toxic to the human being as well, in hopes of killing the cancer before you kill the patient. But the targeted therapies are more going at it with a tweezers to try to go down to the very particular spot where the action is and deal with that core problem instead of just hitting it with all guns. Is that more or less right?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. You know, with the, you know, of course, in oncology therapy, there are various modalities of treatment. There's surgery, radiation therapy, and also chemotherapy. But within, you know, what you term as chemotherapy, there are the harmful or the relatively non-selective classical agents that are used, and then there's this new generation of targeted cancer therapy. And the traditional chemotherapy is non-selective. It could be, you could say it's like a sledgehammer, because it acts mostly through inhibiting cell growth. It doesn't act through inhibiting just cancer cell growth. It acts through inhibiting all cell growth, and it does that by affecting cell division, or it affects DNA synthesis. And so, as you can imagine, if you're inhibiting all cell growth, there's going to be a significant side effect profile, and that's what. And you see that in tissues or organs that have a large amount of cell turnover. For instance, the mouth or the stomach or hair follicles.
Hair follicles, yeah.
Right, which everyone knows. And so it's a very interesting field. There's a lot of considerations that biotech or pharma companies have to take into consideration when kind of looking at a new target and finding, if I'm going to be using these tweezers and identifying a certain target to pick off, and how do I know that it's the right target? And the first is that it has to be very selective. It can't be something that is found on every cell within the body, or if it is found on most cells, it has to be overexpressed to a high degree in cancer cells. And for instance, the target of many antibody therapies today are certain mutated proteins that are only found within cancer cells. Or their targets like CD55, which is overexpressed to a high degree in cancer cells, where it's overexpressed, it's been found in colorectal cancer anywhere from 2 to around 70-fold in more than 80% of colorectal cancer patients.
Wow.
So the selectivity is a big concern, but there's additional considerations too, like is the target even druggable? You can find this protein that's very selectively found in cancer, but if you don't know any way to impact that molecule using known drugs or chemistry, then it seems a non-druggable target. And as hard as pharma and biotech companies will try, they just can't find a therapy that works against it. And another consideration when identifying a good target is that it has to be kind of a mediator of the cancer. It can't be like a downstream effect. And this is where you get into kind of what is cause versus correlation that you see so often in the medical literature. So is this target something that's really important and critical to the functioning of the cancer cell? Or is it just just an indicator of it, and no matter what you do, no matter if you neutralize this activity, it may not have any effect. So ideally, you want to find a target that is the central driver of the cancer cell, and they deem those oncogenes or proto-oncogenes.
Right, something that promotes the process as opposed to something that's as a result of the process.
Right.
So let's say if we go to an accident scene, for example, and we see that there's blood all over the pavement, one could say, oh, well, the blood caused the accident. Well, no. Blood is the result of the accident. whereas the ice on the pavement is more likely the cause of the accident. And sometimes sorting that out can be difficult until we really understand the process really well.
Right, right. Exactly. That's very well said. Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned in your press release that you're focusing on screening libraries of approved drugs for their use in low-cost development of cocktail drug therapy. So cocktail drugs is where we mix multiple drugs, right? And how do we figure out the ones that we might want to put into this cocktail? Tell us more about screening libraries.
Right, right. Well, there's... I'd say that the idea for this stems from looking at combination therapies for different cancers and for altogether different indications. This isn't work that's necessarily focused on inhibiting CD55, but the drug libraries that are used can be fairly extensive. They could include every known FDA-approved drug, which could be hundreds of drugs. The libraries could also even be larger. They could be hundreds, thousands, or millions of molecules that are proprietary to large pharmaceutical companies, and that they represent really the full chemical diversity of what man knows about these molecules. And so the undertaking of doing a high throughput screen or screening protocols can be pretty burdensome. It can cost a lot and can take a long time.
But it's all computer driven now, right?
Not necessarily. I mean, some real work needs to be done. When you're doing a high throughput screen, it's usually done in a cell model or in it's done against a protein in solution. So you do an initial screen on a computer to look for molecules that may be effective, but then you have to decide which drugs you want to test in your screen, and then you have to do the actual work in the lab, where you're screening, you're doing hundreds or thousands or millions of experiments on a small scale in order to look for a drug that works in a particular model.
So we're looking for an existing drug, one that's on the market. You mentioned Avastin before, or one of these others, that would synergize well with what you're doing, and so that the combination of that drug plus your drug would be a winning combination?
Well, we're doing some of that also, yeah. I mean, our cocktail drug discovery program is somewhat separate from what we're doing in developing the anti-CD55 targeted cancer therapy. But,
okay.
Yeah, part of what we're doing is looking at whether or not our anti-CD55 therapy has synergy with Avastin. It's already proven to have synergy with rituximab, a marketed drug. So we have some ongoing work right now at the University of Nottingham that's looking at that.
So, and it's helping the drug get through that resistance phase and keep the cancer cells from escaping the effects of the drug?
Right. Yeah, there's different in vitro models. In vitro meaning it's work done in the lab on cells or on different proteins in solution in a dish that help kind of guide you, to tell you, whether or not this could have an effect in the clinic, because we're not prepared for clinical trials yet with
right.
that therapy. Go ahead.
I was just going to say in vitro means in glass, so if you picture it in one of those little glass dishes in the lab.
Right, right, or in a glass vial, right. And and how you choose the model is something that is very important in drug development. Now there are examples of models, preclinical models. These are either animal models or they're in vitro models that just simply aren't that indicative of success in the clinic. You could have great success in an in vitro model, and it doesn't necessarily mean that the drug will be effective at all in clinical trials. And that's been kind of the one difficulty or one obstacle in drug development for years. And in fact, there's a researcher that is at Harvard now that was doing work in Italy that knew these problems well. He knew that animal models of disease, especially in cancer, aren't very indicative of what happens in clinics. And where you can have a biotech drug that looks very promising initially, but then it cures cancer in mice or in rats, but then once you get into the clinic, it may not be effective at all. And so he did a study where he looked at testing models, animal models, versus clinical trial results side by side. So for every patient that obtained a certain therapy, he would test that same therapy in an animal model of the disease, or two or three animal models of the disease. And he eventually found a genetic animal model where he had modified the DNA of a certain rat or mouse animal model and found it to almost perfectly mimic the clinical setting, where whatever, if a therapy worked well in the animal model, then it worked well in the clinic. If a particular cancer type or a particular drug made resistance occur in the cancer, the same thing occurred in the clinic. So it was really exciting work because once you have that model that works really well in the lab and you know it translates well into the clinic, it becomes quick work for pharma and for biotech companies. And for instance, this work has kind of transformed a fatal form of leukemia into one that has a 70 to 90% cure rate.
Wow.
And it was all done in a very rapid or short period of time, where he found this model that worked, and then after that he looked for combinations of approved drugs, and he was able to find, I believe, a two or three drug combination that worked well in the model, and they marketed it. So in 2-3 years they had identified this drug that gives patients a 70 to 90% cure rate. So it's pretty exciting stuff when it works.
Right, and the reason these animal models are important is that they turn over generations a lot faster. So you can, what would take 10 to 20 years in a human being will take something measurable in weeks for mice or days for Drosophila fruit fly. So if we can prove the concept, at least in some of these other animals, then it's very much to our benefit. But as you say, the environment inside of a mouse is not quite the same as the environment inside a human, and the same thing with a Drosophila fruit fly or any of the other animal models, quote-unquote, that they're using. So we do have to be cautious about that. I remember, what was it, the cover of Time magazine in the 1970s, mouse cures cancer, proved to be somewhat ambitious. It didn't quite, cure cancer in mice, but that didn't quite do it for humans.
Right. If you're a mouse or a rat, you have an excellent prognosis for cancer. there's a lot of therapies that cure cancer in mice and rats, but they just don't have the same effect in humans. Like you say, it's the same exact problem across different diseases and with different model organisms. They all simulate some aspect of the human condition better than others, and that's why research is a very active area of basic biomedical research, that they're looking for new model organisms, they're looking for new models that translate well into the clinical situation.
Right, and then when you get to clinical trials, I know I'm going to a meeting tomorrow with the FDA to talk about the study of how they're going to change the clinical trials process, because it's really been worrisome for us as patient advocates. You have a clinical trial and they say, well, we want this particular kind of person in the trial, and I deal mostly with a rare disease, VHL. So they'll say, well, we want people who are kind of sick but not too sick, and of course the people who are the readiest to sign up for a clinical trial are the people who are running out of options, you know, who are really sick, and they don't want those in the trial. So you have to be able to walk in, you can't be in a wheelchair, and you have to be able to do this, that, or have tumor A but not tumor B. And so they're constantly making the pool of people smaller and smaller, and then they wonder why they can't get enough people to be in the trial. So there are all kinds of problems with that. I think the other problem we're running into is things like, they'll say, well, you can't have blood pressure that's higher than this, and you can't be on more than one blood pressure med. Well, you effectively have eliminated most of the patient pool over 55 years old. You've probably also eliminated a lot of African Americans. And so you wind up trying this drug on a fairly rarefied population, and then it gets approved, and guess who's going to take the drug? All those people with those things that were not allowed into the clinical trial. So you wind up with a drug that really never was tested for people over 55 or with high blood pressure or under 18. And it's been quite a challenge. Do you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, I mean, what's the meeting you're going to first with the FDA?
It's some people from the FDA meeting with some patient advocates through the National Organization for Rare Disorders.
Okay. Yeah, but the clinical trials infrastructure in the U.S. is fragmented, and you know, many would kind of say it's in crisis because many biotech. I mean, it's in crisis for industry because it's very difficult to enroll patients in clinical trials, and you know, a major reason, you know, like you say, is the eligibility criteria, where you're limiting. Or they're so exclusive that it's very difficult to find patients that fit into the criteria that can be put in. But I mean, there's a host of issues that are related to that, and you know, there are working groups. Like I've read about people proposing a national cancer clinical trial system that's kind of updated for the 21st century, and this is. There's a work group at the National Cancer Institute that's put together a host of suggestions where a cooperative group program between different cancer centers where they could all communicate and they could all implement these various suggestions. But one of them, is loosening up the eligibility criteria, or at least very, very carefully thinking through the pros and cons of what those eligibility criteria are, and ensuring they're not too exclusive. But you know, one other interesting one interesting problem I found is that often patients just don't know about clinical trials being an option. Part of this review of the system found that only 15% of cancer patients knew that a clinical trial was an option for them. So 85% of patients didn't even realize that they were eligible to enroll in a clinical trial. And you know, of course, when they asked these people after the fact, 75% of them say that they would have been willing to enroll in the trial. So patient awareness.
Or at least consider it.
And I mean,
one of the other things, though, is if I'm in a difficult situation, fighting for my life, basically, with this cancer, I want to make sure that if I spend the next 6 months taking this drug, that it's going to benefit me. And I think that's part of the issue, is that nobody can guarantee you. And as a matter of fact, in those fair disclosure statements, they are very careful to say, this drug may or may not benefit you. We really don't know the answer to that question.
Right,
and that's
right.
Pretty scary when you may only have 6 months to play with.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's, I was reading about why cancer patients who are aware of clinical trials don't participate, and the number one reason is that they believe they would be better off taking the standard treatment.
Right.
And close behind is something very similar, that where they have a belief that the standard treatment would be more effective than the experimental treatment. I mean, it's almost the same thing, but yeah, it's more than 60% of patients that decline clinical trials do it for that reason. But I guess and another big factor is that patients fear that they're getting a placebo rather than actual treatment, which is kind of a misguided belief, because in oncology trials, the placebo, or the kind of the control, is actually the current standard of care. So you'd be receiving either an experimental therapy or the current standard of care. You wouldn't really be receiving what people think of as placebo, which is like a sugar pill that doesn't do anything, right? Especially in cancer, when you're thinking about targeted cancer therapies and these new agents that have low side effects profiles, they're actually being added to standard of care. So your option in the clinical trial is either I'm going to receive standard of care, the current treatment option or the normal treatment option, or I'm going to be receiving the current standard of care plus this new investigational drug. So, it would seem to make more sense to. I mean, it would seem a pretty decent option to enroll in the clinical trial. And I've heard oncologists say that they think every cancer patient should enroll in a clinical trial. everyone has their own reasons for saying yes or saying no, and I'm not trying to compel people to do that. And I'm sure these clinicians aren't either when they're saying that, but they're just kind of to emphasize the point that enrollment is a major concern, and they think oncologists feel that every patient out there as a benefit to the system and for their own good too should enroll in a clinical trial. So,
well, and as a matter of fact, children with cancer generally are enrolled in clinical trials at a very high rate. I forget 80 to 90% range. Most children with cancer are enrolled in some clinical trial because there's a lot of multi-center cooperation amongst the pediatric oncologists around the country, whereas that is not true for adults. And certainly for rare diseases, we wind with the single-center clinical trials, that if I want to be in the clinical trial, I get to take myself to New York or Houston or wherever it is twice a month for a year at my expense, stay there for 2-3 days in a hotel. This is a huge commitment in time, in money, and in time away from your job, time away from your family, at a time when you're feeling very, very vulnerable. And so a lot of adults, I know a number of them, have declined to participate in clinical trials simply based on the logistics and the time.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. And there's also incentives that aren't there on the other side, I was talking about awareness. The doctors aren't always incentivized properly to make patients become aware of clinical trials. They may not be reimbursed for their time and expense and the extra work that has to be done in helping them enroll and helping manage their care. In that case, there may be no incentives in place for following them and reporting on that data. There are a lot of problems, I'd say, with the system, but the good news is that some smart people are working on solutions and trying to implement them. So.
Right. Hopefully we'll make that better. But I think your point is important to emphasize, and that is that there's a lot of potential benefit amongst these new drugs, because when you're trying a new drug these days, you're not just taking a poke. You are embarking on validating, finding out if, in fact, the drug is better, validating the next generation of drugs. These are drugs that are, for the most part, based on a lot of accumulated knowledge and wouldn't have gotten this far if they didn't at least show some promise of being better than the standard of care. Because the the pharmaceutical company betting, what, $1.5 billion that this is, in fact, going to be better than the standard of care?
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, drugs that, you know, aren't that effective, yeah, they usually do get weeded out. And again, you know, with many oncology clinical trials, you know, what your options are in the clinical trial is the current standard of care or the current standard of care plus this promising experimental therapy. So, yeah, I mean, it would make sense to be excited about enrolling in clinical trials.
Right. So if people are curious about your product, is it anywhere near a clinical trial? Is it something they should be talking with their oncologist about?
No. So our drug is still investigational. It's at the preclinical stage, so it's not available as a marketed drug or even in a clinical trial yet. We're still around 18 months before we would initiate or we would obtain an investigational new drug filing with the FDA. And, you know, after that point, we'd be conducting a phase 1 clinical trial with it. But not yet.
And you said in your release that you're involving universities, you're trying to set up relationships with academic centers. Why is it important to get the universities involved in this?
Right, right. Well, I believe it's very important because drug discovery and the process of developing new drugs that are highly effective and, you know, have the potential to cure cancer and other diseases is very much biology-driven right now. It's very much it's driven by basic academic research, you know, which is performed at universities. And if it wasn't driven by this basic biology, the large pharmaceutical companies would have automated the process of drug discovery by now. They would have set up these high-throughput screening methods where millions of compounds are targeting every known protein or druggable target in the body, and they would just be churning out year after year new therapies that are very exciting and impressive and improve upon the standard of care for cancer and also for other therapies. But, you know, what we found is that, you know, that just isn't the case, and we know that because large pharma and biotech companies have invested tens of millions of dollars over the last decade in these high throughput screening methods, which are highly automated, I mean, there are examples of success, but I think most in industry would agree that it's just altogether not that effective at this point in time. And
so it still takes those intelligent little cheap student worker bees to get in there and spend hours and hours and hours in the lab?
That's right. It still requires that grad student who complains about his benefits and toils away on late into the night and on weekends, and as an example, it's kind of a hybrid example, but one of the best examples of a highly effective therapy is one that, you know, was based on basic academic research that came out of university, and then it was later translated into a drug by a pharmaceutical company, and this was based on academic work that was done in the 1960s, the University of Pennsylvania, and also the Fox Chase Cancer Center. And they discovered an oncogene there, and they deemed it the Philadelphia chromosome, or the Philadelphia translocation. And researchers from Novartis took notice that these academics found this oncogene, this molecule that really drove cancer and caused cancer. And they discovered through high throughput screening methods a drug that was effective in inhibiting this oncogene. And the world now knows this drug as Gleevec, and it was on the cover of Time magazine. It's something everyone associates as being a miracle drug, and it's one that's turned chronic myeloid leukemia into a chronic condition, which was quite fatal beforehand. And so that's an example of just basic biology. Labs, people in a lab toiling away at the mechanism of action and teasing out what's causing cancer versus just being correlated with it, and then finally having some success and figuring out what actually causes cancer, and then a drug development company stepping in, cherry picking off of that information, and then developing a new drug that ends up being highly effective in causing cancer regression. And, similarly today, we're not the only company that is collaborating with universities. A lot of people realize that much of drug discovery is biology-driven. Pfizer just recently struck a deal with the University of California, San Francisco, where they're going to pay them $85 million over 5 years to conduct biomedical research. And,
so the first step is we have to understand in exquisite detail what's going on inside the cell. So if A connects to B, which causes too much C, which causes too little D, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right. Yeah, and as soon as you know that information with certainty or good enough, then the large pharma companies can really step in and they can automate the process of drug discovery and drug development. And then, at that point, again, where you understand the biology well or good enough, then it's likely that companies will have great success and start churning out new therapies that are effective and improve upon the standard of care kind of year after year. But, at this point, it's just not the case. But it's not to say that we won't get there eventually. It may take 20 years or 30 years or 50 years.
Well, thank you so much, and good luck with your development, because it certainly sounds very exciting. This is Robert Brook from Genesis Biopharma, and you have a website you want to tell people about?
Sure. We're at www.genesis-biopharma.com.
Great. Thanks very much. And if everybody would, please go to vhl.org. That's like veryhappylife.org. And check out our pointers to the discussion about the Grey's Anatomy. There are a series of three episodes of Grey's Anatomy this season. It's season 5, episodes 10 through 12, feature a patient with von Hippel-Lindau disease. And the discussion is when one of these shows depicts a character with a rare disease, how important is it that the rare disease be depicted fairly, that it be a realistic kind of scenario, and that the patient be treated appropriately. I wrote a guest blog into KevinMD, and you'll find the pointer at dl.org. They got some pretty interesting responses from doctors. And one of the things that transpired is that the Kaiser Family Foundation, actually did a survey to find out how much credence people put into medical shows. How much do they believe what's there? Is it understood to be fiction, or is it understood to be fact? And in fact, a surprising number of people think that they're looking at true depictions of diseases. So I'm on a bandstand to try to make sure that when these diseases are depicted on medical shows, that they're done so fairly. And so far, there have been four depictions of people with VHL, and all of them have been truly weird, badly overdone, and the current patient was badly overtreated. So anyway, we have a survey up, and you can vote to try to get that message through to the script writers. Thank you very much. I hope everybody has a great week. We'll see you again next week. And be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you.